Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Well, award-winning author Joshua Whitehead's new book of nonfiction is called Making Love with the Land, out through Penguin Random House, and he joins us here on Turning Pages. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, I want to start with something that is in the book, but also something I've seen you talk about in interviews, and that's around the issues you had around Johnny Appleseed and people equating Johnny with Joshua, and then the questions that were then raised that, you know, contrasted your lives, compared your lives, or brought up, you know, some difficult things. And whether you had any of the thoughts about that experience when you went into writing something that is Joshua on the page, and whether there was some trepidation or any caution in the way that you approached this work.
Definitely. I'm back in Toronto now. I just came back from the Eden Center, where I wrote that bit about Joshua and Johnny being conflated and confused. So I'm kind of brought right back to the same space, in a different mind space, or a different head space, a different heart space, and, you know, a couple of years down the line. Mm-hmm. But for me, yeah, I would say, like, Making Love with the Land really kind of came from some of, like, that was a prime moment that became the motor of this book, I suppose I would say, of thinking about, you know, the expectation of, you know, non-Indigenous writers, people who may be curious or allies who don't have, you know, perhaps the language yet or the understanding fully to kind of grasp the difference between fiction and nonfiction, specifically from, you know, an Indigenous writer. You know, in the moment of, like, the TRC, you know, with the James Smith folks happening right now, the unearthing of the Kamloops 215 and onwards, I think people are trying, you know, to raise allyship and awareness, but are being thrust into it perhaps without, you know, the kind of the agency or the ethics or protocols of knowing how to approach, you know, a book like Johnny Appleseed. And so it specifically denotes on the front that it's a novel. But I think there is this expectation and the skill set that we've learned, you know, as readers and as writers, but just as overall readers of lit text since public school, since kindergarten all the way to wherever we went in school, is to, like, pull apart the text and, like, find the speaker beneath, right, and burrow into that. And I think often we conflate a speaker of a text with, you know, the writer of the text. It's something that I'm always trying to differentiate for my students, specifically when poetry is a big one they do this in. They'll be like, you know, let's say John Candy wrote this, but the speaker is John Candy. So I'm trying to differentiate that for them. And so there is quite a bit of trepidation, I would say, with Making Love with the Land. But I wanted to, you know, I was being asked all these questions from left, right, and center, some great, some a little invasive, but all kind of excavation, really, to kind of have a semblance of trauma or a semblance of a life experience that consolidates and conflate speaker with writer. And so it really kind of makes it perhaps confession in a sense, or a testimony, really. And so Making Love with the Land was my attempt to take all those questions, pile them into a pile, and, like, write them out so that they would all be available. And I kind of feel like it's a behind the scenes of Johnny Appleseed, but also Joshua with Johnny, so that you can see the difference of these two people. And I, as Joshua Whitehead, the writer, can attempt to, you know, move out of the gigantic shadow that Johnny Appleseed has cast across the landscape of Canadian literature right now.
Right. So it sounds like in some way this is, you know, other people trying to do some excavation on you because you've written this piece of work. And that's, like you said, something we've all been trained to do as readers from kindergarten on. This is, like, self-excavation as, like, a preservative kind of, or, like, defensive tactic in this. Like, hey, I'm going to ask these questions of myself and answer them for you so that you're not foisting this upon me afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, self-excavation for self-preservation. I think it's, like, a cue that I took from my character, Johnny, who very much understands his agency, but also understands the hungers and thirsts of those seeking out indigeneity, specifically queer indigeneity, within the text as a cybersex worker. And so he very much strips on his own terms and it's kind of like boudoir or it's kind of like a very skilled stripper, really, who knows the cues of when to like remove and is very much in control of their own agency. So I wanted to control the pronoun I and the EYE of my own peering into myself on the page and within this book in a way that, you know, people were doing this to me or expecting me to do it on stage. And I was like, I will give that to you, but I will take a cue from Johnny and strip on my own terms. And I guess in the kind of excavation that something like memoir or nonfiction takes, you know, there is, it's just like, it's kind of like paleontology as well. Like if you dig too deep or too quick, or you're not careful around, you know, the edges, you can crack fossil, or, you know, you can crack petroglyph. And so I was like, I know the canyons and the graveyards and the necropolis of my own kind of excavation. So I thought, let me do it on my own. I will delve down for you because I know the pathways and I'm not going to get stuck in this like one, this kind of small cave that, you know, cascades into a space that you can never kind of recover from or retrieve yourself from. So I think it was, yeah, an attempt to preserve my own mental health and my own sanity and my own care, and, you know, bring along people who want to come on this ride with me, and I'll hold your hand through it. But it's a guided tour, really. You don't have free access to kind of go off the path.
Right. And jumping off of your paleontology notion, like, you know when to use a brush versus when to use a shovel on yourself.
Exactly. Sometimes you got to use that like, fine little brush.
So structurally, I know that some of these were birthed in other forms, right? In the acknowledgements, you do write about kind of, you know, journals and other opportunities that you had to kind of like bring these in a nascent form before they became what they are in the book. Had you written those initially with a sense of like expanding upon them or, you know, building them up into what they are in this book? Or did that kind of like come about after you'd written something and think, I want to go back to that. I do want to like dig deeper.
Yeah, the collection is like the 10 essays that are in there span from 2019, like spring 2019 through to the, I guess, the kind of the very end of lockdown, at least the third wave of lockdown and COVID in 2022, very much this year. So the Pain Eater is the last one. Res Dog, Who Names the Res Dog Res, was the very first one I wrote. And when I was starting these essays, and I was writing them during the tour of Johnny, some of them, for example, Who Names the Res Dog Res was one, A Geography of Queer Woundings was also being written while touring with Johnny in about 2018, 2019. And for me, they were kind of just self-reflections and personal entries for myself to kind of process the things that I was feeling, what I was going through. And putting it on the page so it became material, tangible, I could touch it, physically put it down and put it away. And I never really kind of sought out to be writing a book of nonfiction or a collection of essays as this is. But, you know, COVID happened, lockdown happened. I think we were all forced very much to, you know, confront ourselves in ways that maybe we weren't all ready to do. And, you know, slow down, live in stasis, you know, be entrapped within kind of the civility of the mundane day in, day out, Groundhog's Day 24/7. And so the essay form was really a form of self-meditation, but also meditation for betterment in the kind of the wreckage of stasis. I'm a very extroverted person. So being forced to be an introvert was not my favorite thing to do at all. So yeah, from that, essays started to kind of be born from that. And then as I kind of amassed this collection, I was like, I think I have a book by my hands. And I was finishing my PhD at the University of Calgary around this time as well, about 2020 going to 2021. I was working on a completely different dissertation. But I had, you know, I had released Full Metal Indigiqueer, Johnny Appleseed. I had edited Love After the End, the anthology of Two-Spirit Indigiqueer speculative fiction. And I thought, why am I going to release a fourth book before I ever finish my PhD? So I thought, you know, let's just kind of take an excerpt of Making Love with the Land and make that the PhD. And so Writing as a Rupture was kind of the doctoral dissertation or the kind of exegesis or artist statement of the book, which originally I didn't want to put in there. There was supposed to be a different essay. But my editor with Knopf, Lynn Henry, thought it very fundamental and foundational to be within this text as kind of the primer of exactly what's happening and what I'm doing with genre and form, but also, you know, the personal and the political, and you know, the use of pronouns, you and I, as, you know, a deeper exploration into style more so than the personal, really. So she was very adamant that we put it in there. So we did. And so we kind of had to, like, it is a rupture in the text, and we had to kind of demarcate where it is. So they have those gray pages in the middle, so you can very visually see you're moving into like a perhaps a different realm or a universe by proxy, by side, that is detailing what this book is attempting to do. So then they all kind of came together in that form.
So why didn't you want to include it? And what was the argument that your editor made that convinced you otherwise?
Yeah, I thought it was just a little too academic. Like, as an academic myself, I'm an assistant professor now in the departments of English and International Indigenous Studies at the University of Calgary. But I also take great fault with the academy at all times in the use of, you know, memorizing knowledge and regurgitating it for the sake of an exam. It's like, I think, useless knowledge production. And I think any type of examination or kind of field work that you have to do is just a complete pageant, and it's useless. No one remembers. I can't remember anything I did in terms of those essays I wrote. Nothing's tangible, nothing's material. It's all kind of subsumed within the institution that is the academy. And I very much think that of academic work as well. No, I'm all here for philosophy and theory, critical theory, you know, literary theory, the works of Nietzsche and Foucault and Derrida. I think they're important, but they're so inaccessible because they're like so laced with, it's like reading a whole different language or linguistic system that you have to like know all of these signifiers. You have to know what a panopticon is. You have to know what post-structuralism is to access these texts. So you have to have read a huge breadth to understand a single essay, which I think is so completely useless for community engagement and community enrichment. So I've always thought of my job within the academy is to like eat all of these theories and then regurgitate them into stories. Like, I think Johnny Appleseed is very much laced with the queer theory, decolonial theories, but it's in the form of a story that, you know, is accessible to all, even those, specifically those outside of the ivory tower of academia. So I was very hesitant to put it in there because I thought it would be isolating. I thought it would, you know, deter readers, specifically in the midpoint of the book, when there's a kind of a shift in terms of tone between the first half and the second half. Second half, I think, becomes more memoir-like. The first half, I think, is more kind of criticism and exploration of language. And so, yeah, I thought it would deter folks, but yeah, again, Lynn Henry thought it was like the perfect, it was the kind of fundamental argument that she thought Canadian literature and editors and publishers and interviewers needed to hear and read of what this book is. Is it memoir? Is it nonfiction? Is it creative nonfiction? Is it autofiction? To really kind of place it and embed it within an Indigenous way of that is just story rather than all of these borders of genres. And I remember we had this conversation. She was like telling me, if you're going to be decolonial on the land and not recognize nation or territory or border or province, you also need to do that on the page. And I had been doing that, but I never thought about putting it in the book form. So I'm happy it's there now. Actually, quite a few people have been receiving it very well and kind of gravitating towards it. So yeah, it's kind of the gravitational center of this whole kind of solar system that is these 10 essays.
Right. It seemed to be placed in the middle because it's the heart, right? Like, I felt like if the book is a body, this is the, like, the beat that, you know, propels all of the, like, I mean, there's the brain thoughts, there's the, like, in your feel it in your toes aspects of some of these essays, but the rupture is the thing that kind of is most propulsive, I guess.
I very much agree that it is the pulse of the entire project's thesis, I suppose, or its aim, right? So I'm very happy it's there now, but it took a lot of convincing.
Right. Now, I mean, you mentioned you come from academic studies and then trying to like kind of push back against some of the like cloistered, like hiving off of knowledge, carving away of language that prevents these ideas from being explored or understood in a wider realm. How do you like kind of address that as someone who's an academic and then like sometimes has to talk that talk, but then through your own work is like taking little cuts away at the, you know, that ivory tower.
Yeah, I think what's being produced in the Academy is very important, is kind of the backbone of a lot of political and cultural and economic movements that are happening across Turtle Island right now, from things like, you know, you talking about bell hooks for BLM, or thinking about Glenn Coulthard for the politics of recognition that is Idle No More, or specifically right now with the Kamloops 215 Plus. They're needed, but they're just like, no one, my grandma is never going to pick up Red Skin, White Mask by Glenn Coulthard and be like, exactly what he's saying. I totally understand it. I agree. She would agree. But yeah, it's just so laced in this kind of pompous language and this pompous expectation of having spent a decade at least in the Academy reading these. So what I think, and this is how I am, this is my pedagogy or my teaching style as well, is like, I don't believe in kind of examinations, finals or midterms. I don't believe in memorizing knowledge. I really do believe in crafting it. So like my whole kind of ideology or my kind of mode of teaching and of learning is like to make something. So instead of final essays, I have my students do creative projects to respond to something in whatever form they've had. And I've had some really rad stuff. I've had, you know, beadwork being done. I've had sealskin mitts being done and talking about hunting as a kind of a teaching lesson as well that responds to texts. I was teaching a fairy tale course once, and we were talking about, you know, how we all consume fairy tales. Disney is this huge machine right now, and someone made a cake, and we had to actually eat the cake that had its fairy tales around it and fondant. And I think people remember that so much more and more, like, you know, kind of longer period of time, if not for the rest of their lives, of having to craft something, of using knowledge to make, and making knowledge material. Or something that you can actually touch or eat or consume or sensorially feel. And I feel like that's what I do as well with, you know, these very important theories that we need, but putting them in a way that is accessible. And so if I can take, you know, Judith Butler and Michel Foucault, and I can take Gloria Anzaldúa, and put them into the character of Johnny. People are reading Johnny's lives and they're like secondhand learning these theories. And I think that is the primary goal that I think the Academy should strive to aim for, is instead of so much writing about community enrichment, actually go out and do it. Going to these rallies, which is important too, but actually crafting material that is accessible to the communities of which we are accountable to. And for me, that just comes in the form of story.
So you did kind of like the cake thing made me think, you know, you do kind of talk about like, right, reading is like a consumptive activity, right? Like that you are the person kind of like laying out yourself, you know, with her like in body form, but you're being consumed by the eyes of the reader and by the mind of the reader. I guess that brings to mind the notion of like the orality of story and how you have to put something down on paper, and it changes it by its very nature, right? It takes what would have been words, the like ephemeral nature of it and the way that that's transmitted, and makes it more of a consumptive device, I guess. Mm-hmm. Do you struggle with that as someone who, like, you know, obviously has to write the books in order for the ideas or the story to get out there in a way that, like, I mean, have you thought like, man, I should just do Johnny Appleseed as a podcast so that people have to hear it and like take it in that way? Or, you know, what goes through your mind when it comes to this like primacy of orality and the necessity of, you know, the written word?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, you go to like a bookstore, you go to a literary event, and now everyone loves to talk about a couple of things. One, the latest book they read. Two, to recommend you something. And three, like their guilty pleasure. They're like, oh, I just read YA and loved it secretly. everyone reads YA. Or like, you know, like something that's like pulp, like a romance or like a Harlequin novel or mystery. And in this kind of sharing of what we've read and what we're reading, people always like, it's like the verb that always comes into play is like, oh, I just completely devoured that book. And it's always kind of struck me, like the eating verbology of it all. I'm like, that's strange. And then, you know, lo and behold, like I become this writer who's also being consumed, like the books are being consumed specifically after Canada Reads. It was like widely read in the house and school. And I was getting all of these messages and emails about people being like, I just love the book. I devoured it. And asking me questions, like, please validate it though. Like, what happened in your life to like, how'd you crack this? Like, how did this become, how does this feel so real to me as a reader? And so like, yeah, the whole kind of the web of eating was the kind of verb that was doing all of this work, right? And so for me, what I wanted to do was, I suppose, eat it myself and regurgitate it on the page, and make it material for myself. But also, it does, you know, the ephemerality of it all is lost when it's put on a page, right? It becomes static. It becomes mute. But I also think that is where the relationship between reader and writer emerges, in that, you know, to read this book, you are being invited as a guest into a space of the writer, not just me. I also have to do this for the other writers as well when I read Black writers or trans writers or any intersection thereof, of reminding myself that I'm a guest into the space, even if it's fiction, poetry, nonfiction specifically. And I think for me, the relationship and the ethics of it come into play wherein the reader, when they come into a book like Making Love with the Land, are forced to put breath to word and animate it for themselves, and animate it between me and them. So in that, it becomes much less of a dead thing, but more of an alive thing. And it creates something that is kin between us as reader and writer. And for me, like that's the formation of a relationship right there, right? And it requires consent as the purchase of this, but also the limitations I place on the essays. There's a, like, again, you can't stray off the path and go down any which way you so choose in the museum of this book. But for me, yeah, when a reader kind of reads it within their own mind or also reads it aloud, that is putting agency and animacy into a something that appears ghastly or appears like beheaded or appears static on a page.
Right. Now, one of the things you talk about early in the book is getting asked the question of like how you write or where you write, and the difficulty you have in answering that, because it's not necessarily like the same thing all the time, but that principally you do write at night. And then later on you talk about, you know, childhood dreaming, and that your mother asked the medicine woman Lillian about your dreaming, and she said, you know, is he flying? Only storytellers fly in their dreams, that this is like he's above something looking down and viewing it and absorbing it as a storyteller. Do you think that the writing at night is a result of that, like childhood dreaming, and that's like how story comes into you?
I think so. I'm very much a night owl. I explore that in My Body's a Hinterland, in thinking about the pros, not just the cons, of something like insomnia. And, you know, the popular thing that when I'm in writing workshops, you know, I have a lot of students ask me, well, like, how do you like achieve verisimilitude, or how does it feel real? And like, again, the thing that I've learned in crafting a character like Johnny, or in crafting even the essays in this, which would have speakers who are me, but they're also speakers individually within those essays. And working on a new novel now, is that I have to sleep with the characters. Sometimes you sleep, it's kind of like a video game or a space in which play is allowed and the imaginative runs free. And so for me, I very much am like burn the midnight oil type of person, because the world's quiet. No one's texting you. There's no emails. You know, there's no sirens going by. Sometimes there is, I guess, but it's a lot less quiet, or it's a lot more quiet, sorry. And that allows me to really kind of focus, because I can become very easily distracted as soon as like someone sends me a TikTok or like an Instagram message on the phone or a text message. And then I get off track, and then it's hard for me to kind of come back into the zone. But for me too, yeah, like it asks like where I write, and people write in cafes, or they go to a pub and they write in a dingy corner. Mine is very much, I would say, in the bedroom and in the dreamscape, because I find like, I just have always had these very imaginative dreams where I'm also like some, I'll have like this one dream that is like very odd or weird or lovely or lively. And I'll wake up and I'll like usually write down some notes, and then I can have this ability to like go back and then continue the dream. So it becomes like a trilogy throughout the night. And you know, a lot of those notations that I've taken down have helped me craft Full Metal and Digiqueer with his, you know, apocalyptic dreams of doom and cyborgs and, you know, nuclear war, which comes from my fascination as a child with a lot of doomsday articles and tabloids. And Johnny as well had a lot of dream sequences, which were very much real dreams that I had that I just gave to him and let him run with, like his most infamous bear scene in the mountains that people love, or the dream at the end where he's like catching fish in this river and he's told he's not allowed to partake in this manly affair. And then Making Love with the Land is full of dreams that I've had as well, specifically in the insomnia piece. And so I really had to reconceptualize mental health at large within this book, but insomnia as a very creative byproduct of late stage capitalism, which for me is very energizing and like reels me back to the unfettered, completely uninhibited imaginative state of what it is to be a child almost. And so like for me, dreams and dreaming are one very fundamental methodologies and very fundamental lessons and tools of being, you know, an OG Cree person from Treaty One within ceremonial rites and spaces, but also really allows me to kind of have this creative fuel that lets me perhaps write beautiful oddities, I might say.
So an adult dreaming is kind of the closest to a childhood's imaginative play for you?
I think so. And I think for me, it like the entire experiences of me as Joshua in this body that I'm in on this earth are like collapsed into the space of dream. But also, I think there's like ancestral dreams in there too. And I think there's like past and present, and there's like futuristic ideas that are all there. And so it's like the most ripe space for thinking and crafting and creating, at least for me. That I have. So like, I do think I do owe that to writing at night, and also the boon of some of the boon of insomnia as not just a parasite, but also as a gifting leech, maybe.
Well, I get what you say in terms of it being a quieter time, right? People are not anticipating, like they're not reaching out to you because they're not anticipating you being up. So when you're up at that point, you're in your own head or you're with your own thoughts. That makes
exactly.
A lot of
yeah.
Sense.
While everyone rests and rejuvenates, like that is like where I get to craft and spill and orate.
Right. And in a sense, you're rejuvenating too through your story, like getting to hear those stories yourself. The dreams, like, do they have to be like when you wake up and you kind of only partially remember it? Is it, oh, this is not necessarily a dream I have to carry with me now because I can't suss the details out. It has to be kind of like fully realized in order to kind of be a dream that you feel is like story presenting itself to you?
Yeah, sometimes it's an image or a sense, or sometimes they're even like lines I've heard others or myself say in these spaces. Like I just wrote down one the other day for this new bit I'm working on. Or sometimes it's like a full-on scene that I can take. But there have been like multiple times where I'm like, okay, I'm going to write this down, and I just like fall back asleep, or I forget it in the morning. I get so mad at myself. So that was gold. But for the most part, I would say like 50 to 60% of the time, I'm able to kind of at least recall it as soon as I wake up, or I do wake up and, you know, put it down in my notes in my phone and head back to sleep. But there's also been embarrassing times where I like accidentally text my sister complete gibberish. She's like, what the hell are you talking about? But yeah, I take a lot from it. It's like kind of like, it's like being in the upside down in Stranger Things, and you get to pull some back up, and like, that's what I get to use those as like little anchors. So I put them on the page and it brings me right back into that moment. And for me, I can start going right from there.
Well, speaking of taking a lot from it, there's a lot to be taken from Making Love with the Land. I have a gazillion questions. I marked down like probably 50, 60 pages of things. I was like, oh, we should talk about this, but we have limited time on the show. I do want to thank you for your time, Joshua, and congratulations on the new book.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for having me.